This is episode 6 of season 4 of The Bad Apples. My name is Klaatu, and if you've never heard this show before, this probably isn't the best episode to start with. What we're going to do this episode is go through listener feedback. And I'm doing this once again because I've just been so far behind on listener feedback, and some of the listener feedback is really good, so I just figured it'd be a good idea to go ahead and cover some of it just in one big episode again. Generally speaking, I don't like to do it this way because I remember that somewhere someone used to do listener feedback episodes. I know Larry and Tom do it, but they do it well. I never really felt like they were that interesting. But trust me, this one is going to be interesting. I think this is going to be interesting because I get a lot of interesting emails from people. And so, you know, I think the first one we should start with, since it's probably one of the ones that I'm furthest behind with, is an email I got from Ken Fallon about, well, it's about networking stuff, it's about the SSH stuff, SSH keys and things like that, also about the Etsy/hosts. So let us listen in on what wisdom Ken Fallon has to impart to us.
Hello, Klaatu. This is Ken. I'm just calling to give you some feedback on episode 00 of season 4. You were going into some detail about adding entries to your etc host file, and I just want to give you some feedback that it's not always the case that the etc host file will be set up to be read by the system. There is actually a file called /etc/nsswitch.conf. NS switch, and that can be configured using the command getent, getent. I'll include a Wikipedia link to some more information on that, but you can also edit that file, and if you do, you'll see that it's got various different entries for how a name switch service is going to be used. One of the entries in there is the host's entry. In my case, it's got files and DNS in there, which means it'll look for files, in this case /etc/hosts, and it'll also attempt to do DNS resolving. So if the entry files wasn't in there, it would only use DNS to resolve the entries. Now, where this might be useful for some of your listeners is if they have kids and they want to lock down a machine at a kiosk, for instance, you could switch that there so that the host line only reads files, in which case etc/hosts is the only resolving that will be done. If you use dig, for instance, or nslookup, it'll still use DNS because it's been told it knows to do that. So for the most part, it won't resolve. But there is a far easier way to do that if you're just using your system for secure copying and you want to, the only reason you want the host names is to make a secure copy and SSH work a lot easier, then you can simply modify your .ssh/config file in your home directory to have an entry for hostname. So what you can do there is, say you have three machines, the first machine you would put in host machine 1, and then hostname 1.192.168.1.5, then new line host machine 2, hostname 1.192.168.1.3, and say your work 1 was host work, and new line hostname space 10.11.12.13, for instance. And in that case, SSH knows that if you type in a hostname SSH work, it'll use the IP address or the hostname as specified in the config file, which I find is a more convenient way to do it rather than having to go to different machines. And it's also quite handy if you've only got an SSH account, a non-root SSH account on a machine. It means that if you modify that file, you can still use the same hostname all over the place.
Yeah, and I've verified everything that he's talking about here. Not that I didn't believe him, but just, you know, I was following along with a tip. And he's right. It's so cool. If you're sitting in front of your computer right now, just break out a terminal and do a left on /etc/nsswitch. That's name server switch, maybe? I don't know. NS switch. Yeah. Name service switch. So nsswitch.conf. and you'll see down where it says, like, hosts, colon, and then it says files, space, DNS. So if you were to take away the DNS entry there, or the presence of the DNS string, then it would only look at the files associated with hosts, I guess, is what is being told to me right now. So that's really cool, and there's a lot of other stuff in there, which eventually, someday, I too will understand. But thanks a lot, Ken, for the information. That's one of those things that that's really useful, and I don't think that one would necessarily figure that out on one's own until one has worked in the IT industry and encountered issues, regarding that. That's just cool, specialized knowledge. I'm sure that it's in some book somewhere, but how do you even know to look for that kind of information? So that's really cool. I certainly found that to be interesting, and I think probably you did too, dear listener, because the man knows what he's talking about. You can't really argue with that. All right. Next email that I got was from a guy with the from line of his email says pants butt. I don't know if that's like his name on IRC or what, but that's what it says, pants butt. So Mr. Butt has emailed me a couple of times now, and apparently he's into some weird, freaky Sega Genesis emulator scene. I mean, I figured that these kinds of things existed because I know that people emulate, like, the Game Boy and Nintendo Game Boy and the Atari, probably, and the Apple IIe. You know, lots of different emulators are out there, which is really cool. I really think it's really cool. And even though I don't really use many of them, I think it's a really cool activity. And so he's apparently emulating Sega Genesis stuff, and I don't know what his involvement is or what that scene is like, and I do want to get him on here for an interview at some point. But he sent me an email about trying out his little application that apparently is sort of a sprite editor for Sega Genesis games. Now, I don't know if he's talking about games that already exist, you know, that you have the ROM to or whatever and can now modify, or if he's meaning games that you are designing yourself. I don't know enough about this process to really know, you know, what it's all about, but it was really cool, and I think he sent it to me for input about, like, the user interface design, which frankly looked good to me. I mean, I didn't really find any fault, except that his full screen mode, you know, the option to go full screen, was not intuitive at all. So I just kind of gave him a friendly suggestion as to how it might be different. He made it different, he posted it, and it was really cool. Now, another cool thing that occurred as a result of his initial email was that I got a real workout on compiling software. I mean, having started out and being a user of Slackware and or Slackintosh, I'm, you know, compiling stuff is not something that I'm a stranger to. That said, there's compiling and then there's compiling, and it's just really cool, to me at least, to be able to talk to a developer, someone who's actually writing programs, and talk to them about compiling, because they're the people who really know compiling. You know, they're the ones, I mean, they're compiling as part of their workflow. And whenever you get people like that, that's when you get the people who really know what they're talking about. So I definitely liked talking to him about compiling. He helped me figure out why the interface that he was asking me about, you know, he sent me the code, and I tried to compile it, and like a noob, couldn't get it to compile, so he really helped me figure that out, and I learned quite a bit, actually. So all around, it was just a really cool experience. Thanks, Pants Butt. I would give you the code, or the link to the code of his little program, but I don't know if it's public, if it's meant for release yet, so I'm not going to. But if he sends me an email saying it's okay to give out the address, or maybe tells me where to tell you where to find this little sprite editor, then I will let you know. The next email is from Ron, a.k.a. Macro Ron. There's this new service out there, I think, called Google Wave or Google Cloud or Google App Engine or something like that. And it's about Google offering the world, you know, hosting for their, not just their code, I mean, that would be Google code, but they're also saying, we will actually run your application on our server. So it's like one of those cloud-based applications. You can have Google manage that for you, up to a certain bandwidth usage. If you make a lot of money, start getting really popular, whatever, then they start charging for it or something like that. But initially, to get your application up on the cloud, out there, accessible, not having to worry about finding your own host to do it, Google will do that for you. I am not a programmer, as I've said a million times before, and I'm not going to pretend to know enough about this to make an intelligent comment on it. So I'm just going to say, it's out there, it's available, it's by Google. Take it as you will. It might be the greatest thing since sliced bread, or it might be something evil and suspicious. I really don't know. Shlomi Fish. That is apparently a humor site, shlomifish.org. And Ron sent me an email about something on there. It was a book called Mastering Cat, and that was, you know, supposedly like a big, thick book on mastering the cat command, which, you know, if you look at the man page for cat, you'll see kind of the gag there is that it's one of the shorter man pages I've ever seen for a Unixy application. I mean, it's cat, the function of it, and a couple of switches, and that's it. The funnier thing still is that when I you know, Ron sent it to me, and I saw the URL, so I knew it was going to be humorous. But the more I read the fake interview with the fake author of the fake book, I was like, actually, you know, I would totally read this book. I would pick up, you know, like an O'Reilly book or an A-Press book on mastering cat, and I would find it really interesting. And I said the same thing to Ron, and he agreed. He was like, yeah, actually, I would totally read that book. We would get that, read it, and enjoy it. And I guess that's the weirdness of it all. Like, how much of a geek do you have to be to actually look at a joke and think, that's not that funny, it'd actually be a cool book? I guess, you know, that tells you you've really reached a point of geekiness that probably no one should ever reach. But there you go. I'll include the link for that one, just for kicks. Next one I got, this is from Deep Geek. Everyone knows Deep Geek from Hacker Public Radio and from Talk Geek to me. Now, Deep Geek says that he's used Qemu before as well, Q-E-M-U. Now, this is an application that I did a Hacker Public Radio episode on, and it's the emulator. It's the free software emulator for a computer that you can install and then run, you know, a different ISO within, or even Windows, for that matter, if you have, like, one killer program that you absolutely need Windows for, you know, emulating it within Qemu could work. And Qemu is different from, like, VirtualBox or VMware or whatever, in that it is, it isn't those. It's Qemu. It's free software. It is what it is. It's its own little independent program. So I like to use it because it's not associated with Sun or now Oracle/Sun or whatever. It's not associated with any company. It's just kind of, as far as I know, some guy doing emulation stuff. And there are probably other better reasons to use it, but it always works for me, so I just kind of keep using it. Deep Geek says that there are some important points about the QCOW2 image that he should make, and one is that they're sparse, meaning that if you copy them with a utility that is not sparse aware, it will expand the file. Like if your QCOW2 image is taking up 1 gig of disk space on one drive, and you copy it using certain utilities, then it's going to end up being a 10 gig file on your destination, which is pretty bizarre and yet true. So luckily, the Unix program CP is sparse aware, so you're not going to have that problem with CP. rsync, we're pretty sure is, but you know, there are going to be other programs that are not necessarily sparse aware, and they're going to inflate your QCOW2 images, you know, from like 1 gig to 10 gig or something like that, which could be a problem. So be careful about that. He also says that there's a kernel module that brings the speed up to normal, which would be as opposed to half speed, for your virtual machine. And this module is available when you're running 32-bit OS. Apparently, it's not around for 64-bit mode yet. So again, be aware of that. I'm in the process of upgrading my operating system to 64-bit, so that could be a problem for me. Or, not a problem, but it won't be an option for me. But anyway, 32-bit kernel module, see if you can get a boost out of your emulated machine. Bit of feedback is from Chess Griffin. He used to have a little show called Linux Reality, and actually this isn't feedback to me, this is just a blog post that he wrote that I just thought was worth mentioning. It was a blog post that he did on June 8th, and it's a little bit about Mono, although basically he's just referencing an article by Chris Smart, who is the editor of DistroWatch Weekly. So if you search for Chris Smart and Mono, you should find this article. I'll also I'll slap a link in the show notes. But the idea, of course, is that Mono is a re-implementation, I guess, of the .NET framework from Microsoft, but that works on Linux. And as with many things in Linux, especially things that have anything to do with Microsoft, or outside technology, I guess you could almost say, the camp is thoroughly divided on mono. It seems like people either rabidly don't care about mono, or people rabidly hate mono. But if you read this Chris Smart article, that might clear up some things. And then my own admittedly very noob experience as I investigate for myself the possibility of going to school for programming, it's kind of started to become clear to me that if you're a programmer and you were trained on .NET, the leap from understanding .NET to understanding something less Microsoft specific like C or C++ or heck even Java or you know you name it is not that far. And this is why many colleges do teach. They teach you practically everything in Visual Studio and .NET. And I had this problem back when I was on the West Coast. I was taking just some random courses in programming, failing miserably at it. But I just took some courses, and it was all taught in Visual Studio, which I would not use. And I just did everything in text files. But it was obvious to me that, you know, they didn't really expect you to only program in Visual Studio from then on. It was something that you would learn and then you could graduate from later on if you needed to. So you don't have schools teaching specifically, or at least most schools aren't going to teach specific languages to every computer science student. They're going to teach programming to computer science students, and the students are going to apply that knowledge of how to program to whatever language a given job requires. So I've managed to find a school that teaches everything in Java rather than in .NET. That'll get me out of that quandary. But in terms of people not being able to program effectively for Linux because they don't have their .NET framework, I'm not buying that as an excuse for .NET's existence. Now, if that wasn't the excuse, and the excuse is, well, .NET's just really good. It's got a lot of cool system calls. It's got a lot of cool things that you can do really easily. All right, I mean, that's cool. That is neat. But I find it a little bit difficult to believe myself that it's really any better than, for instance, Qt. Or even, you know, whatever the framework in place, I guess the GNOME framework, you know, all these different frameworks that already exist that seem to have been doing really, really great for us so far. I find it hard to believe that Microsoft is so far advanced that their .NET is that much better than the stuff that we've already developed for ourselves. So these facts combined with the big fact that this mono stuff is basically, I mean, it's Microsoft technology, and Microsoft, I mean, they have publicly declared Linux as a competitor, you know, or if you want to go into the pseudo-quasi-religious terminology, you know, their enemy. And so this means that they're going to compete with Linux. They're going to attempt to beat Linux in any way possible. I'm not saying that they're going to try to kill Linux from existing. I mean, I'm not accusing them of operating system genocide, although some people might. And people with more knowledge about Microsoft's history would be better suited to predict that. But for me, I just know that Microsoft is a business, and their bottom line is for themselves to succeed above and beyond anyone else. So you can believe, and this I know from the way businesses work, you can believe that this is not a gift from Microsoft. This isn't a goodwill thing that they're doing for Linux users everywhere. That's not their goal. I don't know what their goal is, but they are not a company that has demonstrated to anyone so far that they are going to do anything but try to defeat Linux. So for us to just accept any technology they throw our way with open arms, as if though it's a magnanimous gift, is just, I mean, it's for us to say, yeah, mono isn't that bad, just seems really, really kind of blind. Because Microsoft is this company bent on defeating competition, and here we are just taking mono in as if though it was a free gift. And believe me, in business there's no free gifts, and Microsoft does have some kind of agenda behind mono. They didn't assign resources, they didn't take this on because they're just feeling good about it. There is something going on here. Don't know what it is. Don't need to know. It's just I know that we don't need mono. So that's what Chess Griffin's blog posting and Chris Smart's article made me think, and in turn made me rant about. The next email is from myself. I don't usually email myself feedback on my show, but I did happen to find the link to that random government site that I mentioned, I think in episode 401 or 402 or something like that, where I had actually emailed the webmaster and said, hey, you're recommending Internet Explorer on your site. Why would you do that? And then they turned around and actually changed the site. So the site, in case you're curious, I just wanted to be complete, you know, is mdarchives.state.md.us. You can also look at mdelect.net. Those are the two sites that I guess I saw the notice on about requiring Internet Explorer. And then I emailed the webmaster and said, hey, you know, you're not, shouldn't be recommending Internet Explorer. And she wrote back and said, yeah, you're right, actually. And she took the message down. So again, if I'd really wanted to use that as a good example, I would have taken a screenshot of before and after. But I didn't know it would work, so I didn't think to do it. Lost in Bronx emailed me, and turns out that he's got a cappuccino machine after one of my fairly recent Hacker Public Radio episodes on how to make a good cappuccino, which if you haven't heard, by all means, go listen to it. It's a good episode. I try to make it as clear as possible. It's very hard to teach people how to make a cappuccino because the frothing, the milk frothing, is it really just kind of, it's all in the wrist, you know? It's just something you kind of have to get the hang of. So he says he's having a little bit of trouble with the froth, but that he did read somewhere that there was a tip that you could chill your cups before adding milk and steaming it. Apparently it says that if you do that, it'll make frothing easier, which I find hard to believe. From my own completely unscientific analysis of the situation, it's bringing the milk up to a near boiling point, and then just concentrating the heat on the surface of the milk so that it forms, basically it would be forming a skin, except instead of forming the skin, it is forming bubbles, or skin in the form of bubbles. So it's making that froth that really persists. It's not just bubbling milk, it's making a concentrated froth that persists over really the heat of the coffee and stuff like that. So I don't know about the idea of chilling your mugs before adding your milk and steaming it, but it's something that Lost in Bronx read, and you could certainly try it if you wanted to. I haven't bothered trying it yet. One of his things that he included is a really cool coffee tip, so I'm not going to read that yet. I'm going to save that for the coffee break and do another coffee tip. If you have any coffee tips of your own, feel free to send them in, because I personally love coffee tips, so go for it. Now, Deep Geek emailed again about Kimu, and this is really cool stuff, and I was talking to him about the idea of having a base system of, I don't know, for instance, Slackware or something, you know, really nice and stable like that, and then just running your actual primary OS within a virtual machine on that computer. He says that it's not something completely unheard of. It's been done before, not usually on a single user machine, but it certainly could be done. And, you know, from this, you kind of gain a kind of a cheruted environment, sort of, kind of like BSD jails, but, you know, basically the idea of a cheroot, a change root, is that your root directory becomes some other directory other than your actual root directory. So when you're making your partitions and stuff to install your OS, you define, let's say, that basically the beginning of your hard drive as your root partition. Not necessarily true, because probably it's /boot, but after your master boot record, then you've got your /, and that's your root directory. So that's your true root directory, right? If someone gets their way into your system and they want to go into your, you know, they want to get root access with root permissions to your root directory, that's where they would be, and they would be able to basically screw up your system from the bottom up. Now, if you're operating in an environment consisting of virtual machines, and the virtual machine is the thing that is the active running environment, then anyone using that virtual machine, to them, their root partition is like this kind of fake hard drive with a /, on it, right? Because the virtual machine has created a fake little virtual PC in your PC, so that your root environment no longer is your actual physical hard drive at the /, partition. It's the virtual PC at that /, partition. And so you've changed your root. It's called a cheroot. I mean, there's a lot of other uses, and this isn't really what cherooting refers to, but it's like cherooting, and that is what cherooting is, where you change your root directory from one thing to another. All that aside, the point kind of is that as things start to sort of lean toward virtualization and stuff like that, the possibility that people might be running virtual environments is something that is very real. And I still might do that. It's still an idea that I might pursue just for fun. I mean, not on my primary computer, of course. But, you know, I've got a couple of different computers, and I might do that. Now, Deep Geek warns me that for 64-bit and for Virtual Machine, well, number one, there's that bothersome module that doesn't yet exist, I guess, for the 64-bit thing, as far as I understand. But, you know, you kind of do want a lot of RAM, really. So if I'm going to do something like that, I'll probably have to make a couple of upgrades first. So next email is from Ron again. The guy's crazy. He just keeps sending me great, great links. This is a really interesting one. I'm just going to have to post this link in the show notes. It's an article by Jeff Moser. I don't know who Jeff is. I don't know if he's reliable or anything like that. The blog certainly sounds reliable. I would give it a read if I were you. Anyway, it's called The First Few Milliseconds of an HTTPS Connection. Interesting stuff. He really kind of just breaks down what happens when you go to an HTTPS site. This is an interesting, really interesting thing, because between this article and a fairly old presentation now done by Dan Kaminsky. I think he did it at a Black Hat, and it's somewhere online. Someone posted the video of it, so you could look up, you could look around for it. And there's certainly worse ways to spend the day than watching a whole bunch of Kaminsky videos. They both are kind of talking about sort of security in a way, because, okay, it's HTTPS means that it's going to be connecting to a certain port, right, like 443 or something, in order to get a secure connection. But, I mean, a secure connection obviously means that there needs to be something going on in the back end, for instance, SSL. But you've got, obviously, the GUI, and this stuff is happening, like, you know, you can view it via, like, Wireshark, but the GUI indications kind of tend to be almost, I don't know, I would say too friendly, because you see these little icons, right? We have this iconography that we've developed on the web, like little locks, you know, and if the picture of the lock is closed, then it must mean everything is okay, right? Does that really mean everything is okay? Well, not really. It's just an icon. It's just a little closed lock icon. It just kind of brings into question, you know, how much do we really know about the security of the places that we're going on to on the internet? Again, big sites like Amazon and stuff like that, you can kind of have, you know, you can assume, you can sort of safely somewhat assume that their security mechanisms are in place properly. But on other sites, you know, you needed some super rare cable, and the only place you could find it was this weird site out of Russia, you know, that wants all your credit card information. Is it safe? Oh, well, there's this little certificate here that says it's safe, and there's a little lock by the password input thing, so I guess we're all okay. You know, it's just kind of like, think about it before you click. So yeah, check. I'm gonna post the link out, the link in the show notes, and I would love to post the Kaminsky video, but there's no chance of me finding it in time to do that. So just look around for it if you're interested. It's a good talk. And this is the blog that Ron is referencing is Moserware, Moserware.com. And it's a post made in 2009-06. And it's just first-few-milliseconds-of-https.html. But I'll post the link so that you can read it if you want to. It is very good. Deep Geek emailed, again, not really for feedback for my show, but his Talk Geek to Me podcast is going strong. I highly recommend it. On the latest episode, at least as of right now, which would be episode 5, he does a review of something called ARIA 2, which is a download manager. He covers GNU versus, you know, non-GNU. He talks about... No, actually, he talks... Check out all of his episodes. In episode, I think it was 4, well, it was either 3 or 4, I don't remember now. He talks a lot about the way he's been designing his site and stuff, and he's been doing some really progressive stuff. I've probably already mentioned this, because it really made an impression on me. But yeah, definitely check out his show if you have not checked it out yet. It's Talk Geek to Me. I'll include a link in the show note for sure. Russ Winner emailed me. Now, Russ is the guy from The Techie Geek, and The Techie Geek is on the Tech Podcast Network, and it's a really good show, and he says it's about Windows and Linux and geeky stuff, although all he ever talks about, as far as I can tell, is Linux, and he goes to the Ohio Linux show, so I think he's just trying to secretly seem like he's more OS not agnostic, but like he embraces more OSs than he really does. But that's just my humble opinion. Anyway, he was watching the live stream that the Ubuntu podcast had over at Southeast Linux Fest and took a screenshot of me standing in front of the camera and sent it to me. And yeah, he's got a good eye, what can I say? I was looking at the stream because I was wondering what software they were using. I didn't find out and I didn't have a chance to ask them because I was really busy. Here's something else from Ron, which is, you know, just kind of astounding. The governor of Virginia, virginia.gov, is giving money to Microsoft, state money, I guess, to train unemployed people in Microsoft software. The argument for this, of course, would be that it's free training in software that they can actually use in the real world to get jobs, ostensibly, assuming there are jobs out there to be gotten. And, you know, you can't argue with free training, I guess. What you can argue with really, really strongly is the fact that someone's getting this government contract. You know, people are, someone, some institution, some company is getting money to train people. And the money is going to either Microsoft or some contractor using Microsoft to teach them specifically Microsoft skills. So you've just got, like, multiple levels of vendor lock-in here. You've got vendor lock-in on the receiving side. They're getting money for a product that they are producing and that only they can produce. You've got vendor locker on the other side, whatever that would be. You know, they're giving away the vendor lock-in to all these people who need training. They're saying, well, here's the Office suite of the world. They're not teaching them how to use computers. You know, as such, they're not saying this is computer literacy to the point where they wouldn't need Microsoft Office Suite training. They would simply be able to sit in front of a Office Suite and figure it out because they know the syntax of how to use a computer. And this is an important concept that basically was my whole argument for the OLPC. A lot of people, of course, at the time of OLPC coming out was that, you know, hey, these people don't need computers, they need food or healthcare or whatever. And my argument, of course, was that actually if you teach people how to use a computer, it just raises their entire ability to use technology, and technology is one of the main things, really, that improves quality of life, at least by our current definition of quality of life. So the idea is to teach people the idea of computing, the skill of technology, of using technology, and teaching them one brand of an Office software is not doing that. It's like teaching, it's like if someone posts a question in the forum and says, how do I, you know, get around such and such an error? Let's say X won't start, how do I get around this error? And you give them a whole big shell script with this cryptic way of removing the .x session file from their home folder and then running an auto X config, Zorg config, and then reestablishing .x session with some with an exec Dart KDE line in it or something like that. You know, something that they're never going to ever understand. And you say, well, there you go, there's your answer. Well, that's not an answer, that's a quick fix. Having explained to them why it wasn't starting, what to look for, and then how to get it started, that would have been the real answer. And such is the case here in Virginia. The answer is not to give people Microsoft Office training from contractors, either from Microsoft or, you know, who only know Microsoft. The answer is to teach them computing, then let them use whatever Office suite they need to use. And of course, it's all theoretical because we all know deep down that what they're going to sit in front of is Microsoft Office. That's beside the point. That's another issue. Part of the solution is to get people trained on computers rather than on Microsoft or Apple or whatever. Let's see. Oh, what do you know? Another email from Ron. He is referring me now to a Sabayon Linux link. Now, Sabayon, of course, is based on Gentoo. This is an interesting distribution to watch because a lot of people like it very much. It's also interesting because it's based on a distribution that is currently in a famous, fairly well-publicized slow death or something. I'm not really sure what's happening with Gentoo, but hopefully it'll be a strong distribution. Certainly, it used to be that the Gentoo forums would come up all the time, and they were always really great forum postings. If I may gripe on a tangent for a moment, now it seems all I ever get are Ubuntu forum answers, and half of the answers on those are three or four clueless people, and I'm not saying I'm not clueless, I'm just saying they're clueless as well. Clueless people kind of poking around at what might be the issue. You know, so instead of getting, like, a Gen 2 forum posting with, like, the question and a great, like I said, answer, which includes not only the line commands to fix the issue, but the reasons why you're running the line commands, you get these Ubuntu postings of, like, four noobs suggesting to each other, you know, what the problem might be. Like, maybe your X won't start because you've got your wireless turned on, you know? You're just like, this isn't why I searched for an answer, you know? This is more people being confused like I am. So, yeah, the Gentoo forums, you know, that was a golden age of forums or something. So, between that and Linux questions, you could almost always find answers. Now it's just Linux questions. But, yeah, so hopefully Gentoo will kind of recover from whatever instability they were experiencing. And maybe Sebi on Linux will help give it a boost, because if people continue using Sebi on Linux, then I'm sure that people are going to be interested in the health and welfare of Gentoo, even if it has to fork, for all I care. But yeah, sebionlinux.org/sebion/presso/disco_eng.pdf. It's a presentation, slides used in like a seminar on Linux and stuff like that. It's a pretty good thing to look at. I would check it out if I were you. I haven't looked at them all yet, but I do like what I see. Turns out Daily Motion is going to support OGG, you know, open video formats and the proper spec that is HTML5. And this is another tip from Ron. And Daily Motion is a big video site. They're not YouTube, but they are obviously like YouTube, and they're fairly big. I mean, they really are. They're a contender. They're a big player in that kind of useless online video space. Daily Motion is definitely there, and they will be using OGG Fiora and OGG Vorbis codec on their site on new video that's being posted. It's going to be available in Firefox 3.5. I am really, really very excited about this, because OGG is free. I'm a supporter of OGG. I release my shows in OGG only. I like OGG, I really do. It's a free codec. It's going to make things like pulling Creative Commons video off the interwebs and throwing them into your video editor of choice really, really easy. Well, unless you're using a video editor that is proprietary and wants you to only use their codecs, then that would be another story. But if you're doing things on the free side of computing, then this is a great, great thing for everyone. Not only does it mean that I don't have to worry about Flash content as much anymore, but it also means that, you know, like I say, I can start pulling stuff from Creative Commons places and actually not have to transcode them myself first. They're already going to be encoded in a format that my free video editors understand. That's huge. It's a big deal. It's a big step toward free codec, free formats, you know, freedom in general. It's a big deal, I think. So thanks, Ron, for that tip, and yeah, that's really cool. Rain from France, favorite listener, Rain, probably my only listener from France, she sent me a link to a multimedia site over at the Berkman Center for the Internet, for Internet and Society, which is over at Harvard Law School. Now, this, the Harvard Law stuff, I mean, they kind of had a hand, I guess, in defining the whole RSS feed spec and stuff like that. So this is a pretty big, well, I mean, Harvard, I guess that's kind of a famous university. So, I mean, this is a pretty big site, and apparently all their multimedia is now going to be offered in, again, free and open OGG Fiora format. So this is another huge thing. I mean, it's really cool. We've got, the Berkman Center releasing a lot of their files as OGG Fiora, and it's even going to, a lot of it's going to be licensed as Creative Commons, I guess, -by, which I believe is the attribution license. So that is really cool. That's going to have, again, just a lot of stuff that you're going to be able to share, reuse, remix, re-edit, whatever, to your heart's content, without any kind of licensing issue concerns, without any kind of transcoding that is going to need, transcoding needing to be done before you can use it. And once again, 1,000 times, you should never have to transcode video before you edit it. That is your least desirable workflow. Transcoding is something that you do after you're finished. That's, you know, a hit to your quality that you should make after you've edited it and have your best quality results. Then you go about transcoding and doing stuff that's going to, you know, compress it and make it technically lower quality. So that's a big deal to me. It's a huge deal to me because having worked as an editor, having to go in and deal with proprietary editors that just refuse to open up, you know, free formats or other proprietary codecs, you know, from competing vendors. You sit there, you're transcoding all this video on one hand, and you've got your client on the other hand saying, oh, I want this to be absolute best quality. And you're just like, well, you've just given me stuff in every imaginable format, and now you're asking me to maintain a high quality. That's not going to happen, dude. But anyway, I digress. Rain also sent me a link to some site called jaredandcoralie.com. That is Jared, J-A-R-E-D, and, the word and, Coralie, Coralee.com. It is a Linux site. It's by some person, or maybe two people, Jared and his friend Coralie. It's about Linux and command line stuff. And one of their posts, I guess maybe their first post, I don't know, is about AVIDemux-CLI. So AVIDemux, or some people call it AVIDemux, is a command line interface of basically a video editing application, or AVIDemux. I've used AVIDemux, and yes, again, it does the job. No, it's not a professional video editor. But, you know, it's a cool little application, and the command line version I've used as well, and I like that, so you can definitely check that out. And actually, that reminds me, so thanks, Rain from France. I need to actually install that on my new 64-bit Fedora 11 system, because that is one thing that I forgot to install. Let's see. Oh yeah, Jonathan D. from Freenode. I actually met him at Southeast Linux Fest. He's one of the staffers over at Freenode, and they have a podcast now. They do. Freenode has a podcast, which is kind of like weird when you first hear it. You know, it's Freenode? How can they have a podcast? Well, it turns out Freenode is actually, you know, a community. I mean, there are people behind Freenode, and we are all users of Freenode if you do IRC, so it's not so crazy to have a podcast from the Freenode community. So try it out. Go to podcast.freenode.net, and they've got podcast up. I still can't find an RSS feed for it, but Jonathan D. emailed me, I guess sort of for help with their podcast, like how can they get the podcast in more of a podcast form, and I emailed them back a fairly long email about, well, here's an RSS feed, here's a sample feed, here's your show in an RSS feed, feel free to use it. Hopefully, eventually, they will have a proper RSS feed for their show, but freenode.podcast.net, check it out. Rain from France, again, sent me an image from a blog called madduck.net. Now, any blog called Mad Duck is okay by me, but the image itself is interesting because it's an ad apparently from Microsoft, and anything on the internet makes me kind of look at it a couple of times before I believe it. And this I don't necessarily believe. But apparently one of the gimmicks, one of their marketing ploys, is for you to use Internet Explorer 8, which, by the way, is not available for Linux, so it's not going to really apply to you. But for people who are using Windows, to get them to use IE8, they've apparently, quote-unquote, hidden $10,000 on the internet, somewhere on the internet. And if you use IE8, you can possibly find $10,000. So it's one of those, you know, use our product and one lucky winner will get $10,000. In the screenshot, they give the URL, microsoft.com/Australia/IE8/competition. Let's type it in and see what happens. And it turns out that, yeah, it's actually a legitimate ad. It's right here on microsoft.com/Australia in the IE8 folder. Of course, it's a .aspx file because they're using Microsoft servers for this. And yes, they are out there, they're doing a gimmick where it's $10,000 somewhere on the internet for using Internet Explorer 8. Now, of course, as 330 would be quick to point out on Linux Cranks, they're probably talking about Australian dollars, so it's probably like $10 in American money, but it is there. It's a competition. Microsoft really wants you to switch to IE8, and Linux Cranks have made poked sufficient fun at IE8 so far, so I'm not gonna go into that again. So here's a coffee tip, because I think it's time for a coffee break. Coffee tip comes from Lost in Bronx. Number one, after you've ground your beans, use the coffee powder as decor for the top of your cappuccino. I think that's a brilliant idea. I usually use like chocolate shavings or cinnamon, something like that. Well, for myself, if it's just me, I don't use anything, but if I'm entertaining and want to make it look good, I'll use either chocolate or cinnamon or something like that. But yeah, the little powdered coffee from the top, fantastic idea. I think it's a brilliant idea. Now, his other really brilliant idea, and this is really cool, but he's been, and this is kind of weird too, but he's been taking the shavings, the coffee, the really, really finely ground coffee. So it's like basically a powder at the bottom of your coffee grinder after you've ground a fair amount of coffee. And he's been saving that in some kind of container, and then he'll use it to make like a Turkish coffee once he's collected enough. So I don't know if you've ever had Turkish or Greek coffee, but this is a very finely powdered coffee. And basically all you do is you boil water, and then you add, and usually this is made in like espresso-sized cups. So you boil just enough water for, you know, two or three shots of espresso. And then you turn the heat down, stop it from boiling, and then you put in the Greek coffee or the Turkish coffee. And then you raise the temperature a little bit to continue it boiling or simmering a little bit. Add a copious amount of sugar, and then serve it. And it's really good. And you can buy Greek or Turkish coffee depending on where you are, like in New York, find it anywhere, especially in Astoria. Every store in Astoria will have it. Elsewhere, you might have to look at like at a quote-unquote ethnic food store or a specialty food store. But you know, in big cities, you can find this stuff anywhere. Or you can save the powder from your coffee grinding and make it yourself. Thank you, Lost in Bronx, for this week's coffee tip. Listener feedback is was again not via email, but it was in IRC yesterday. I was talking, the Last Known God and I had been talking some time ago now about getting IRSSI to give you visual notifications if someone says your nickname. And you know, IRSSI in most terminals will kind of like make your name bold or turn it a different color. But, I mean, we want something to, like, flash or blink or something. And turns out if you're using an RxVT terminal, and actually he says specifically a URxVT terminal. I don't know what URxVT is. I'd never heard of that one. I used to use RxVT on Slackware, on my Slackware box all the time. Lately I've just kind of been deferring to, like, console. But I might switch back to RxVT or investigate URxVT just for this feature. But what you do is you put, and I'll post this on the site as well, in the show notes, but you put in your home directory, in your .x defaults, you add the line URxVT.urgentonbell:true, and then in IRSSI, you have to run /set bell_beeps on, and then that's one command, you hit return, and then you also do /set msg_level:msgs_notices_dcc_dcc_msgs_highlight. So, you got that right? Yeah, I'll definitely post that in the show notes so that you will be able to actually follow along with that better. Yeah, one thing you should check out is shellium.org, shellium.org. It's a place where you can get free shell accounts from Brian Stein. He's the guy I interview in either 404 or 405 404 actually, because he's the guy from the Florida Linux show. So he runs shellium.org, shellium.org, First, you need to register there, just as a user of the site. Then you have to go into their IRC chat, their channel. See, I almost said chat room. Their IRC channel, and let them know that you want a shell account, and they will set that up for you. Oh, the Blender project. I know I said that I wasn't going to update everyone on the Blender project all the time on the show, but why not? Josh Thoth emailed me again, just kind of commenting on some stuff about Blender. I'm working with Nick, who is a guy from my lug, who I rode down to the Southeast Linux Fest, working with him locally on just kind of looking at the Blender code, kind of getting accustomed to it. It looks like 2.5 is going to be adding at least some major differences into the video sequence editor, if not, you know, probably not the exact specific changes that for instance, that I've basically been requesting. But yeah, there, you know, it's being looked at. Like I say, it's not necessarily something that's going to happen overnight, but it is being looked at. Someone wrote in, and I don't remember his name, so I'm going to have to look it up and put it in the show notes. I'm sorry. My system of organizing all my different listener feedback has been not very good. As of this episode, I've improved it vastly. But, yeah, so Monica, M-O-N-I-C-A, is a screen calibration software for Linux, sort of. It's essentially a way of adjusting your monitor settings, but it's not so much a way to make sure that one screen's gamma setting and color temperature is exactly the same as another screen's. So it is and it isn't what I think it was Tim Big Rig was writing in about, or someone had written in last season asking about screen calibration. And I think during my brief break between last season and this new season, someone wrote me about this Monica program. So, on one hand, yeah, it does screen calibration, and then on the other hand, it doesn't, because it doesn't take into account the actual Kelvin temperature reading of that monitor's output, and that's true screen calibration, and that's what things like, you know, the Spider and all the different little hardware devices would actually do for you, which I still have not used, so if anyone's had experience with those on Linux, free to tell me about it. Jesse James, a.k.a. J-S-C-H-I-W-A-L, Jay Schwal, has posted a really nifty shell script on the Linux Cranks forum. It is an OGG to MP3 shell script, so yet another answer to the conundrum of this podcast only releases in OGG, I need it as MP3, what do I do? Well, here's a script for you guys, and again, I'll post the link in the show notes, and it's a really cool shell script. He did a good job on this. It maintains all of your ID3 tags by grabbing all the ID3 tags. It's really cool. You gotta, if you're not gonna use it, I mean, I don't use the shell script, I don't need it, but you should look at the shell script, just read it through. I read it through and learned quite a bit, so definitely read this shell script through, because it is pretty cool. My website for the show notes. You probably need this one this time. It's thebadapples.info. You'll want to look at the show notes for this episode, because it's definitely going to have a lot of links in it, including the tip from the last note got about, you know, setting RxVT or URxVT up for IRS SSI notifications. So check that out. Thebadapples.info. Thebadapples.info/Blender. For the Blender project updates, which I need to make. And I think that's about it. I will see you next time.
It smells really good.